class divisions in our society played out as a force in the most recent presidential election, with Trump winning in part due to the overwhelming support of poor white folks. Even before the election, issues of class and socioeconomic status have been very important to me, both personally and professionally, including where the two intersect. The personal is easy to trace. You see, I am the product of a welfare mom, and I say that with pride, especially pride in my mother. It used to be much more difficult for me to talk about this because of the stigma. There is judgment and shame attached to the phrase welfare mom, but we all know there should not be. So why is that? Why is it that when folks need public assistance, we collectively do not think of it with gratitude, happily acknowledging that all the abundance in our society can assist those in need? After all, the definition of welfare is the state of being happy, healthy, or successful. That is a good thing. We should wish it for everyone and gratefully share all that we can to ensure the existence of welfare. My mother worked hard her entire life. Born into abject poverty, she was raised by a single mom in post-depression Laramie, Wyoming, after her father, whose name was Bob Vance, that'll come up again a little bit later, after he abandoned the family. She grew up determined to have a better life and set her sights on becoming a nurse, a career girl, even though this was the early 1950s when most women weren't thinking that way. She started nursing school, but then along came my father and her plans were derailed. She thought she had married well. My father was a Korean War veteran studying at the university, but she thought wrong and ended up raising 5 children and supporting a bum husband on her own. Even though she found ingenious ways to fit more work into one day than anyone I've ever known, there was still not enough to support a household of 7 and not enough time to work multiple jobs outside the home, as she was also the one cooking dinner and parenting the children. The term working poor would have fit my family, as it fits so many across our nation. The assistance of the public made a huge difference for my family. Without it, we would have had no health care, would have lost the house we lived in, and might not have had enough to eat. My mother had too much pride to accept the cash assistance for which she qualified, but she did accept food stamps and Medi-Cal. Then she stretched every penny she earned to keep our family together. My father died when I was a teenager, and ironically, he then started supporting the family through Social Security survivor death benefits, yet another societal safety net. And then over a decade later, my mother remarried, and having a second household income and no dependents at home afforded her an economically secure life. And when I went to college, I was further assisted by the public. Social Security dependent survivor benefits helped me pay for college until President Reagan took them away. Maybe that's why I'm not a Republican. In addition, I was a scholarship kid. I received maximum need-based financial aid thanks to state and federal assistance programs. I was the first in my family to graduate college. Those of us who have benefited from public assistance do not have the opportunity to thank the public for their support. At this point in life, it is very clear to me that public assistance played a critically important role in my childhood and young adulthood, and I am extremely grateful. So I will take every opportunity, including this one, to say thanks to you, taxpayers in this room, thanks to the taxpayers in California and across our nation, for sharing your abundance with those in need. Thanks for enabling my mother to raise us when I was a kid, and thanks for providing basic health care for us. Thanks also for supporting my education. I would not have been able to start my lifelong love affair with higher education without the financial aid that supplemented what I could earn as an undergraduate. I like to think you all made a good investment in my family and me. I also believe we are currently collectively making a great investment and hundreds of thousands of Americans through public assistance programs. I've reflected on this, and I can say with certainty that my motivation to give back is the primary reason why I work at a public two-year college, to try to ensure that other kids have educational opportunities who otherwise would not. But class origins can haunt a person. I was a valedictorian of my very small rural junior high school, but when I entered my freshman year of high school in town, I was baffled when I found I was not placed into college track courses. Other students from my junior high were. Evidently, the powers that be assumed that I was not going to go to college. Maybe because no one in my family had, maybe because of the way my family looked or acted, I'm not sure why. But they did not put me into college prep classes. I had to fight to take college prep classes, even though I was a top student. And go to college I did, and found it so engaging and liberating, I never wanted to leave. In fact, I've managed to stay in college my entire adult life as either a student or an employee. In graduate school, I even studied college through the Graduate School of Education at UCLA, where they have a specific doctoral program in higher education and organizational change. My dissertation was on how college mediates upward mobility, a topic near and dear to my heart. So I pondered issues of class, which isn't always easy. We don't talk about class much at all, at least not in polite company, except perhaps to pass judgment on those living in cycles of dependency and poverty, or sometimes the opposite extreme, the 1%. But I have found those who were raised in poverty generally refer to their blue-collar roots and believe they are from the working class. And wealthier folks will say they are middle class, or perhaps upper middle class. I've yet to hear anyone identify as being part of the upper class. Many social stratification models reinforce this. They show the upper middle class extending to the 99th percentile. How can that still be considered middle class at the 99th percentile? It makes no mathematical sense, but it allows us to not identify the upper class as such. While we do not seem comfortable talking about class, we can read about it. There are many good biographies out there that trace lives out of poverty into higher classes. I especially like the ones where education is the saving grace. A few classics come to mind, such as A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, written by Betty Smith in 1943, Hunger of Memory, Richard Rodriguez, 1982, and Angela's Ashes, Frank McCourt, in 1996. There have also been two bestsellers in the recent past, both, I believe, worth a read. One is The Glass Castle by Jeanette Wells, written in 2005. It was made into a movie last year. And more recently, Hillbilly Elegy, written by J.D. Vance in 2016. So there's that name again, Vance. Remember I mentioned my grandfather, Bob Vance? J.D. Vance, the author, could be my cousin. Vance is the family name of my lowest class white origins, people who came from the same parts as J.D. Vance. Hillbilly Elegy was published about 2 years ago and got a lot of press as, in part, an explanation of why uneducated whites voted for Trump. Vance's family roots are in Appalachian Kentucky, where he was born, but like many impoverished folks from that region, his family moved up north to Ohio for better jobs in what we now call the Rust Belt, where they ended up faring no better. While Vance's autobiography predated the presidential election, he speaks with insight about disenfranchised poor whites in a way that might help explain the election. He says, "Surveys have found working class whites, by which he means poor whites, are the most pessimistic group in America, more pessimistic than Latino immigrants who suffer unthinkable poverty, more pessimistic than Black Americans whose material prospects continue to lag behind those of whites. While reality permits some degree of cynicism, The fact that hillbillies like me are more down about the future than many other groups, some of whom are clearly more destitute than we are, suggests that something else is going on. He continues, indeed it is. We, and again he means poor white folks here, we are more socially isolated than ever, and we pass that isolation on to our children. Our religion has changed, built around churches heavy on emotional rhetoric, but light on the kind of social support necessary to enable poor kids to do well. Many of us have dropped out of the labor force or have chosen not to relocate for better opportunities. Our men suffer from a peculiar crisis of masculinity in which some of the very traits that our culture inculcates make it difficult to succeed in a changing world. As this passage helps illustrate, class is complex. It's not just about money or economic capital. Social class is about more than income. The term socioeconomic status generally includes measures of education and occupational status in addition to income. The three are generally correlated, or what a younger generation refers to as intersectionality, but not always. And there are even more factors at play. Many of you have probably heard the notion of social capital, or networks, social relationships that have productive benefits. Social capital is found everywhere there are people, and there are class differences. For example, knowing who to know and how to navigate the networks of inner city street life is valuable social capital for those who live there. But it does little to improve their socioeconomic status. On the other hand, golfing with corporate executives can. Then there is cultural capital, or the social assets of a person, such as education, intellect, style of speech, dress, etc., that promote social mobility in a stratified society. Cultural capital allows people to fit in a particular setting. For example, think of a fancy dinner party with a lovely table set with all the extraneous silverware. Who knows the proper etiquette for which utensil to use when? Why and when is it important to demonstrate this knowledge? Here's a different example. Research shows the ability to identify classical music composers is strongly correlated with academic attainment, regardless of program of study. Why is that? It's not because those earning graduate degrees are all required to know classical music, right? It's because those who go on to earn the highest level degrees tend to come from higher socioeconomic backgrounds, where they were more likely to be exposed to classical music. I can tell you, symphony attendance was not part of my childhood, nor did I ever learn to use all those fancy forks and spoons. But now, if any of you were at a lavish dinner party and the topic of classical music composers came up, how many of us would fit in? How many of us would be able to join the conversation and use the silverware properly? How many of us would even be invited to the party? Who goes to those parties and why? Wealth and education are correlated. The more education one has, the more likely one is to be wealthy. The New York Times recently published some new research which used federal tax returns as definitive proof of what many already knew. Elite colleges and universities enroll students from the upper echelons of our socioeconomic strata. In fact, the cited study found that the most elite colleges enroll more students from the top 1% on the wealth scale than from the entire bottom 60%. Let me repeat that. More students from the top 1% of income enroll at elite colleges than from the lower 60% of income. Why is that? Are rich students smarter? No. Although research shows wealthier kids tend to go to better elementary and high schools and have more educational opportunities. Are rich students more deserving? I don't think so. Rather, I believe our system of higher education sorts students in a way that reinforces social stratification via social and cultural capital in addition to economic capital. Can this cycle be broken? Of course, I and many others are living proof of that. But unfortunately, we are the exceptions and not the rule. The same New York Times article showed that all students who graduate from those elite institutions, whether formerly poor or rich, tend to have the same high outcomes and land up in the upper class. They have made it, regardless of their class of origin. Once they earn that elite diploma, it is hard to tell who initially had stars upon bars. The problem is the door to those elite colleges is open wide to the rich, but nearly closed to the poor, regardless of academic ability. This helps explain why few from the lower quartile of society ever go to college, let alone to a more prestigious college that would result in more prestigious outcomes. But we see higher education as a key to upward mobility, and clearly it plays an important role. But while education can buy a ticket onto the upward mobility train, there is no guarantee you will reach your destination, especially if you are short of social or cultural capital. Social mobility is tricky. J.D. Vance gives a personal explanation in his best-selling book, Hillbilly Elegy. He says, "Though we sing the praises of social mobility, it has its downsides. The term necessarily implies a sort of movement to a theoretically better life, yes, but also away from something. Social mobility isn't just about money and economics. It's about a lifestyle change. The wealthy and the powerful aren't just wealthy and powerful. They follow a different set of norms and mores. When you go from working class to professional class, almost everything about your old life becomes unfashionable at best or unhealthy at worst." It follows, then, that not all desire to leave behind their social norms and mores for a radically different lifestyle, even if it means more creature comforts. This is a common theme in all the autobiographies I mentioned above. The movement from poverty to higher classes necessitates leaving a lot behind, often including close relationships with family, and those leapfrogging social stratifications in their upwardly mobile lives can feel immense stress. As J.D. Vance put it, and I've heard reference to in my own family, those whose lives dramatically improve can often be referred to as too big for their britches, clearly not allowing them to fit in back at home. So how did all of this tie into we Unitarian Universalists? Well, for one thing, Unitarian Universalists are a very well-educated denomination. In the past, the Pew Research Center listed Unitarian Universalists as the most highly educated denomination in the United States. Recently, Hindus have taken that top spot, but UUs come in a close second. A full 67% of Unitarian Universalists hold a college degree. That's two-thirds of us, university educated. Compare that to 59% of Jews, 26% of Catholics, and 19% of Southern Baptists. Are we a denomination of the super-educated? Well, yes, maybe, but not all of us. And even though Unitarian Universalists are very well-educated on the whole, we're not the wealthiest denomination. That list is topped by Jewish, Hindu, Episcopal, Presbyterian, atheist, and agnostic. UUs are about in the middle of the household income by religious domination, even though we top the education chart. I'm not sure what's up with that, but I think it's fascinating. At this point, I'd like to read an excerpt from Class Lives by Felice Yespel. What's class got to do with it? Class is the last great taboo in the United States. Even in this period of growing economic inequality, we hardly ever talk about class. Sometimes I think of class as our collective national family secret. And as any therapist will tell you, family secrets are problematic. Most of us believe that the United States is a classless society, one that is basically middle class, except for a few unfortunate poor people and some lucky rich ones. We've been taught from childhood myths and misconceptions around class mobility and the American dream. Many of us are confused about class and don't tend to think about it as concisely as we might, as consciously as we might our race, ethnicity, gender, religion, age, or sexual orientation. Nonetheless, our class identity has a huge impact on every aspect of our lives, from parenting style to how we speak, from what we dare to dream to the likelihood we will spend time in prison, from how we spend our days to how many days we have. This calls me to cite a few of our UU principles, and they are dear to all of our hearts. Respect for the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. Acceptance of one another in our congregations. The goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. And respect for the interdependent web of which we all are a part. So given that we are a socially stratified society with a somewhat stratified denomination, as UUs are generally quite highly educated, what can we do to intentionally be inclusive of all and to create space that is welcoming to all? I leave you with more words from J.D. Vance, the hillbilly who could be my cousin. At one point in his book, he explains how white lower class opposition to Obama was not about race. In his description of the attitudes toward Obama, he also explains how there could be support for Trump. What can we learn from this for our denomination and for our efforts to promote justice, acceptance, and respect for all? Here are Vance's words. Many of my new friends blame racism for this perception of President Obama. But the president feels like an alien to many lower-class whites for reasons that have nothing to do with skin color. Recall that not a single one of my high school classmates attended an Ivy League school. Barack Obama attended two of them and excelled at both. He is brilliant, wealthy, and speaks like a constitutional law professor, which of course he is. Nothing about him bears any resemblance to the people I admired growing up. His accent, clean, perfect, neutral, is foreign. His credentials are so impressive, they're frightening. He made his life in Chicago a dense metropolis, and he conducts himself with the confidence that comes from knowing that the modern American meritocracy was built for him. Of course, Obama overcame adversity in his own right, adversity familiar to many of us, but that was long before any of us knew him. So I ask how we present ourselves in congregations. Might we seem as foreign to some folks as Obama is to lower class whites? Are we signaling class in a way that might turn off visitors? I pondered this quite a bit as I wrote this sermon, which reads in part like a university professor's lecture citing statistics and research and authoritative sources. Are these words interesting and accessible to all who are here this morning? And what about those who are not here? Would any of the 16% of Marin County residents who voted for Trump feel welcomed here this morning? How can we, as a denomination, heal divisions to work collaboratively towards a better future?